Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. The usual two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Michael Taft, an economist with the joint Irish and British Union, Unite. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from the political theorist Jody Dean on Occupy and Demands. Before all that, some words in the news. Friday morning brought the release of the employment stats for December. It was a strong report, though not quite as strong as it looks on the surface. Many of the gains are likely to be reversed in January, but the trend of modest, steady improvement continues, and manufacturing had its best year since 1984. Now some details edited for radio. Employers added 200,000 jobs last month. Over a fifth of that gain, 42,000, came from couriers and messengers, meaning all those FedEx and UPS folks delivering holiday packages ordered from the likes of Amazon. Online retailers had a great December. Not so much for brick-and-mortar retailers, who'd apparently expected otherwise and hired ambitiously, adding another 28,000 to the headline figure. Given the ultimate disappointment to the holiday season, retail store-wise, and the explicitly temporary nature of the courier jobs, these gains, which together accounted for over a third of the total, are likely to be reversed when we get the data next month. The eat, drink, and get sick sectors returned to their previous strength after slipping in November, as bars and restaurants and healthcare together added almost 50,000, a quarter of the total. There are good jobs in healthcare, and also lots of not-so-good ones, but with an exception I'll get to in a moment, the strongest sectors were either evanescent or low-wage, or both. This is hardly the bold acceleration that some insta-pundits were touting on Friday morning. Maybe they're Democrats. In the negative column, temp firms, where hiring is often a portent of strength to come, and vice versa, and government, which continues to shed workers. There was surprising strength in manufacturing, a sector where employment fell by a third between 2000 and 2010, and where the absolute number of workers employed is well below what it was in 1947, even though the workforce has tripled since then. For the year of 2011, the factory sector added almost 200,000 workers. That's the best gain in percentage terms since 1984. More on the manufacturing revival in a minute. The numbers I've been citing come from a survey of about 300,000 employers. There's also a simultaneous survey of about 50,000 households. The household survey gave a less upbeat picture than its employer counterpart. It showed no change in the share of the population working, but it did show a decline in the unemployment rate from 8.7 to 8.5%, the lowest level in almost 3 years. Hidden unemployment was also down, with the number working part-time for economic reasons and those classed as not in the labor force but wanting a job now, both falling sharply. As a result, the broad U6 unemployment rate, which includes those folks along with discouraged workers, that is, those who've given up the job search as hopeless, that U6 rate fell 0.4 of a point to 15.2%, its lowest level in almost 3 years. Still very, very high, but at least it's going in the right direction. But the unemployment rate, which is down from its recession peak of 10% in October 2009, has been flattered by what's known in the trade as labor force withdrawal. That is, you're not counted as unemployed if you're not actively looking for work. Many of the unemployed have simply given up on finding work, so they're not counted as unemployed. So even though the unemployment rate is down a point and a half from that 10% peak, the share of the adult population working for pay, the so-called employment population ratio, is exactly the same now as it was at that peak. That's not what we'd see in a normal recovery. We're still 6 million jobs below the pre-recession peak at the end of 2007. At the growth rate we've seen over the last 6 months, it would take almost 4 more years to recoup those losses, and thus not even counting population growth. We're still in a very deep hole and emerging only slowly. And now a few more words on that manufacturing revival. Friday's Wall Street Journal had a piece on how Caterpillar, which has been doing quite well lately, is threatening to close a plant in Canada and move operations to a low-wage site unless it gets big concessions from its union, the Canadian Auto Workers. That low-wage country it's threatening to move to? the United States. The journal also reports on other manufacturing firms moving south from Canada, but without going so far as the Rio Grande, Siemens, Navistar, and Electrolux. The reason? American workers are very productive, but they earn a lot less. Caterpillar claims that its workers in Illinois cost the firm less than half as much as their comrades in Ontario. Over the last decade, unit labor costs, wages and benefits paid per dollar of output, have fallen by 13% in the U.S. They rose by 2% in Germany, 15% in Korea, and 18% in Canada. When you factor in transportation and other costs, U.S. workers in some sectors are now starting to become competitive with China, where wages have been rising sharply for years, and workers have developed a rude habit of striking and even ransacking the boss's office. The trend towards bringing factory work back to the U.S. even has a name now, onshoring. A revival in manufacturing would be good in many ways, but one based largely on low wages and high levels of exploitation is not something one can get very excited about. Back after a musical break to talk about the wreckage of the Irish economy. That was some of the first movement to Beethoven's Sonata for Cello and Piano No. 3, performed by the Son and Father team of Adrian and Arthur Brendel, cello and piano respectively. My first guest is Michael Taft, an economist with the joint Irish and British Union, Unite. Taft was born in the U.S. but has been in Ireland for a long time, so you can hear both countries in his accent. He also writes a blog called Notes on the Front. The Irish economy experienced a long boom from about 1997 to 2007, but it was a hollow one, based heavily on a wild housing bubble. It got caught up in the financial crisis that began in the U.S. in 2007. First, the economy started slowing, and then the banks that had financed the bubble began emitting ugly and frightening sounds. Since then, the Irish economy has fallen apart, generating mass unemployment, deep budget cuts, and great social distress. Michael Taft was on this show in October 2010 to talk about the disaster. Here he is with an update, Michael Taft. Okay, welcome, Michael Taft. So it's been a bit over a year since we talked, and I imagine the Irish economy has not improved over those 14 or so months.
That's correct. Since we've spoken, the Irish economy has actually gone into an EU IMF bailout. And secondly, while there was some growth earlier at the beginning of last year, along with the rest of the Eurozone countries, that was very short-lived, and we're now preparing to go back into a double dip. The last quarter results showed that the economy was in contraction again. The EU Commission has projected that our domestic economy will be in recession next year. And the government has recently produced statistics with its budget that it introduced showing that employment is going to contract again, consumer spending is going to fall, investment will fall. This year looks to be fairly grim. It's hard to see any upside.
What is the unemployment rate doing and what's happened to the job market?
Well, the unemployment rate is between 14 and 15%. Now, that doesn't, of course, include people who are underemployed, casual workers, those marginally attached to the labor force. When you include those figures, we're looking at about 20 to 25% of the labor force that cannot find full-time or even permanent part-time work. In addition, as we've discussed before, it's hard sometimes to read the unemployment figures in Ireland because they're quite fluid. We have high levels of emigration, which are hard to estimate because we never get any current figures on that. But it's estimated that about 3% of the labor force are emigrating every year. So a better look at the labor market is to look at those people who are in employment. And for the fourth year in a row, that will contract next year. There'll be this year, it's the new year. There'll be fewer people at work this year than there were last year. And that employment has been contracting ever since 2008. In fact, there are some very grim projections that suggest that we will not reach pre-recession levels of employment till well after 2020. Such has been the substantial decline in the jobs market here in Ireland.
Now, you mentioned immigration. I believe we talked about this last time, but for a while, the longstanding habit of Irish people leaving their country was reversed, and people are actually, on balance, entering Ireland. What's the status of the flow?
That's correct. During the Celtic Tiger boom, we had large inflows, not only Irish people who had previously emigrated and returning home, but a lot of what we call the new communities here, or non-nationals, coming in, especially from Eastern Europe, to get work during the building boom. Now, that has reversed. We've had now emigration for the last 2 years. As I say, unfortunately, our data collection is very poor in this area, but it is estimated, as I say, about something like 2 to 3% of the labor force is exiting every year. Initially, that was, again, a lot of the Eastern European labor, which is essentially migratory. I mean, a lot of it's, you know, building work. So they came here when there was a building boom. There's the London Olympics, so a lot of them have gone to London building work there. But equally, there's a high level of Irish emigration, Irish national emigration. And this is occurring to a large extent among graduates, you know, people who are in long-term unemployment, who are living in chronic poverty. They don't have the capacity, you know, financial or otherwise, to emigrate. So we're finding a lot of emigration among graduates. They're especially going to Australia, where there's a reasonably lively jobs market. Or they're even being picked up in certain areas in Britain and in Canada. And I suspect there's some emigration to America for specialist labor. These are people who have the skills that are sought elsewhere. So in one sense, the immigration, it's not just bad for the economy, but it also means that we are reducing our skill base in the future. And that's something that, you know, will hit home within a few years.
You mentioned Britain. The British economy is, of course, not doing very well either. Has that had an effect on Ireland?
It's hard to assess to date because sometimes these impacts lag, but there is concern because within our domestic sector, that is the especially in the food sector, which is Irish owned, a large part of that trade is with Britain, and therefore any reduction in demand in Britain is going to impact on our exporters selling into that market. So we should start, you know, we will see that will be part of the impact that will feed into declining exports. But it's not just Britain. I mean, the Eurozone is predicted by many to re-enter recession, and a large part of our trade is with other Eurozone countries. While our domestic demand has continued to fall, our exports have held up reasonably well. But now we should expect that for at least the first 3 to 6 months of this year, exports to continue falling off, and that will feed into our double-dip recession.
How are the banks doing?
Not well. We have, in the last 6 months, recapitalized them again. I can't keep count how many times we've had to push money into them. It would be, I think this last time it was about 12 to 15 billion euros that we put into the banks. And to put that into some perspective, that's about 7% of our GDP. So imagine 7% of the American GDP, those dollars going into banks. The two main banks, our private banking system is dominated by two main banks, are still totally reliant upon ECB funding. There is no way that they can stand up in the market. They are totally reliant on the government's bank guarantee, which was again renewed recently, because they wouldn't be able to go out and borrow medium or long term in the market without that guarantee. Essentially, without the guarantee and without the ECB funding, our banks would be insolvent. And in fact, in a technical sense, they are insolvent. So the game plan is for the banks to sell off about a third of their assets, which means for the Irish, that's pretty bad news for the Irish economy. Because if you are trying to, you know, downsize your loan book, you're not likely to be releasing new credit at the same time. So we're going to find that the banks will be not only taking the taxpayers' money in the form of capitalization, they will be hoarding capital, they will be squeezing their loan book, which means no new credit, and that's what's happening to a number of even reasonably profitable or at least reasonably well-surviving Irish firms. That are finding it hard to get credit for cash flow reasons or overdrafts or whatever. So the banks are making no contribution and cannot make any contribution to economic recovery for the next few years. And then, of course, there's the famous Anglo-Irish Bank, which I think the New York Times once said nearly brought down an entire nation. We are, you know, we are spending, again, the equivalent of 2% of our GDP every year for the next 20 years paying off that debt. It is horrible. It is the largest bank bailout, I think, in the history of the world, I think some historians have found. And it will continue to drain the economy and put pressure on our ability to borrow in the international markets if we ever get back into the international markets in the short term.
You said the banks are planning asset sales, but what are they going to sell and to whom?
This is the big question, because European banks in general are trying to downsize their assets. So you have hundreds of billions, if not trillions, of euros worth of assets going up for sale. Well, who's going to buy them? Obviously, it's a terrible time to be selling any kind of asset in that kind of market, and especially in a recession market. So it is hard to know. Now, it's kind of a joke here, especially in Dublin, but that our five-star hotels are doing great business because we're getting a constant flow of investors from abroad coming over to Ireland and picking over what assets they can pick up for bargain basement prices. I mean, it's a vulture capitalist dream over here because banks are ready to sell just about at any price to offload their assets.
I'm speaking with Michael Taft, who is a research director with Unite the Union in Ireland. And now, what about the budget? The government has been, of course, cutting. It's been one austerity program after another. They just keep coming?
Yes, they again, the government, and this was well signaled in advance, brought in a budget which was largely made up of spending cuts, capital spending, cuts in public services would have come next, and then cuts in social welfare. There were some marginal tax increases, but the tax increases were highly regressive. There was increases in VAT, value-added tax, which is a sales tax and therefore regressive, and a wonderful little tax called a household charge, whereby everybody who owns a home pays 100 euros a year, regardless of whether you're unemployed or you own a mansion up in Howth Head. It's a flat rate tax. So it is expected by many commentators that we will have a mini budget come around May or June. A mini budget occurs when the budgetary, the year's budget figures are, you know, going offline, if you will. There's a fear that tax revenue will collapse in the early part of this year. That higher unemployment will, of course, increase public spending, and they will have to bring in a budget mid-year to, cut more spending and to increase more taxes. But of course, at every turn when they do this, they then have to revise the growth projections downwards, and as a consequence, they have to revise our debt levels higher. All this trying to chase targets set by the EU IMF, which cannot be met under austerity policies, because it's like running in quicksand. There has been a recent debate because a leading economist, who would by no means be called progressive, but actually left the country because he said this wasn't the place to raise his family. We will be looking into about a decade of austerity. And that's probably not an exaggeration, because everybody's trying to focus on this magical Maastricht target guideline that we have to bring our deficit into -3% of GDP by 2015. But what everybody forgets is, even if we were to achieve that, we will still have a very high level of debt, the highest, second highest in the EU behind poor Greece. And therefore, we will have to spend another number of years trying to bring down that debt. So it's hard to see, with this type of fiscal contraction going on, where the growth will come from.
Of course, it's easy to say that austerity doesn't work, that it just makes things worse. But does Ireland have any alternative? Could it possibly fund a Keynesian stimulus program or investment program?
It would probably be not wise to try to, say, stimulate consumer demand in a small open economy. A lot of it would leak out of the economy. It's hard to see how one would do that in any event, because right now, whatever money people are able to grab, unless you're on the lowest income, in which case you have to spend everything you get just to, you know, to make a to have a decent living standard. But people are trying to get out from under debt. We have one of the highest levels of personal debt in the industrialized world. There is a long-term process of deleveraging. That debt is mostly mortgage debt, which was racked up during the Celtic Tiger boom. So that kind of traditional, you know, stimulate the consumer market type of stimulus would probably not be very helpful. But what Ireland can do, and we do have the resources to do that, though much of it has been squandered on the bank bailout, we still have a sizable amount of cash and assets on hand in which we could pursue an investment program. An investment program is key for a small open economy, because in order for us to become competitive, we need high levels of modern infrastructural capacity, technological innovation, and education. All three areas, by the way, where Ireland falls down considerably, except is just in one part, you know, the modern multinational sector, which is mostly foreign owned. But in terms of our physical infrastructure on the island, in terms of our indigenous enterprise base and our educational system, we are very much below EU 15 par. Now, an investment program that was directed at that would actually create jobs and therefore create growth in the short term. But actually, much more key to that is it would increase our productive capacity in the medium to long term. And that's where the real gains have to be made.
When we spoke last, you pointed out that the whole economic strategy of the last several decades of luring branch plants to Ireland to get inside the EU walls has really not succeeded, that they really didn't put down much in the way of local roots, didn't source locally, no spillovers. Has anybody begun thinking about that and trying to come up with an alternative strategy for the longer term?
Not really. Certainly not the government. As you know, a new government was elected. The previous incumbents were kicked out, and a new government made up of Fine Gael and their junior partner, Labour, came in, and there's no indication of that thinking. In fact, what obsessed them for the first 2 or 3 months in negotiations at the EU level was to protect at all costs the 12.5% corporate tax rate. The Minister for Finance actually described it as sacrosanct, which is a kind of an odd term to use for what is essentially a utilitarian tax policy. There is still this belief that the multinationals can deliver an export-led recovery. And, you know, there's nothing to suggest that will be done. On the other hand, in terms of what they claim making the domestic sector competitive, what they are doing is trying to dismantle what little collective bargaining power that lower-paid workers have, we have joint labor committees, which set rates, say, in the hotel and restaurant and retail sectors, the lowest paid sectors in the economy. The government is trying to dismantle that because they put forward the argument that by cutting the wages in those sectors, businesses will have more money in which they can use to create more jobs. Now, this is just an absolute nonsense. The only reason that businesses are going to create more jobs is if there's a rise in aggregate demand. But you don't increase aggregate demand by cutting the wages of people who are low paid anyway and are spending everything they get in their pocket. So we have, on the one hand, a continuation of trying to woo in foreign direct investment, which, by the way, there's nothing wrong with that. But they don't seem to have grasped the necessity to build a strong indigenous enterprise. And when they do look at indigenous enterprise, all they see it is through the prism of wage devaluation. In other words, we must cut wages in order to become competitive. All they're doing is actually just exacerbating domestic demand and further deepening the deflation that we're stuck in.
What are the human consequences of this? With the unemployment rate this high and just this relentless sense of crisis and no hope for the future, what's happening to the mood of Irish people?
Well, I think in many cases, the Irish people, they are numbed by this experience. They've been made to feel guilty, as if the Irish people were responsible for the housing boom, rather than reckless European and Irish banks and reckless government regulation of the financial sector. They also don't see an alternative because the one party that might have been able to provide that, Labour, our Social Democratic Party, is now in government implementing austerity measures, much as the Greek Socialist Party was in power doing that and the Spanish Socialist Party was in power. Now, neither of those two parties are in power anymore. So there isn't really a feeling that even if there were an alternative that could be formulated, that there's any way possible of getting that implemented. So people are just bearing up. Those who make a reasonable amount of money are still saving. They are saving because university fees have been increased, because their children might not get a job and will obviously be needing financial assistance, or they may need financial assistance when they emigrate abroad. There's talk of closing public nursing homes. So a key category of people of the age of 50, 55, who might have a lot of disposable income to spend, are saving it up because they're looking at, the nursing home costs for their parents or relatives. All these factors then surround the core element of poverty. Our Central Statistics Office, which is our data collection agency, published some horrific figures that nearly one in four people actually experience two types of deprivation throughout 2010. Things like being unable to afford heating for long periods of time during the winter, unable to afford to buy a raincoat or to have two pair of shoes or to go out with friends once a month. Nearly one in four are experiencing two or more of those types of deprivation. Income inequality has jumped sizably. In fact, it's jumped. It was the biggest jump in single-year figures in income inequality since the founding of the EU, or the statistics going back that the EU collects for any other country. So that combined with the fact that nearly one in 10 of people who have a mortgage are now in distress. Their mortgages are distressed. They're either in arrears for 90 days or longer, or their mortgages have been restructured to pay interest only, which means that, they're having income problems at home. So 10%, and it's likely to rise over the next 2 or 3 years because the labor market's not going to pick up and because the government has admitted that wages after inflation will continue to fall for the next 2 or 3 years. So people are just trying to get on, as best they can, and the option for a lot of young people to emigrate is being taken up more and more.
And finally, in Greece you see people rioting in the streets and kicking up a fuss. Do you see any signs of that in Ireland, or all those years under the tutelage of the Catholic Church made the Irish people too well-behaved?
Well, I, maybe Catholic Church should keep them well behaved. I mean, the influence of the Catholic Church is pretty much nil nowadays. Unfortunately, I don't see that, because I think that what needs to be done in any society is those type of protests are either going to be led by either, say, the social democratic or left parties, or by trade unions. Now, in Greece, there were strong left parties, you know, that weren't part of the Socialist Party government, and there are strong trade unions, and they were the ones that organized and led these protests and marches and all that. We unfortunately have not had that. Now, each time the Irish Congress of Trade Unions, which is our trade union federation, called a march, that was three times in the last 3 years, 100,000 people turned out. And 100,000 people on an island of 4 million, that is a huge amount, you know. But if you do it proportionately, that's an incredible turnout. So it's not as if Irish people won't come out and protest, but there's no agency there which has the respect of Irish people, which, as I say, would be the main Social Democratic Party or the Trade Union Federation. There's no agency leading that. So people don't just spontaneously come out, you know. Not everybody just kind of, you know, arrives in the middle of O'Connell Street, our main street in Dublin, at 12 o'clock on a Saturday. Someone has to organize those things. There's no that organizing agency, and I think that people have stopped believing that there, in any event, that there is an alternative. And that's probably the worst news of all. In some ways, you can always put up with the bad economic situation, but when the politics so deteriorates that you believe that public and collective action is futile, that is a real depression.
That was Michael Taft, a Dublin-based economist with the joint Irish and British Union, Unite. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back to talk Occupy Demands after a musical break.
Society is all around. Oh, yeah, the beautiful sound of all the high-pitched squeals. Ecstatic brilliance at its finest. That's my friend. Society is all.
That was some of Society is My Friend by Kurt Vile, with a V, not the Germanic W. I don't think he really sees society as much of a friend. Which is probably not the most appropriate setup for my next interview, a return engagement by Jody Dean. Jody teaches politics at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York. She's the co-author, along with Marco De Ciris, of a very interesting piece on the Possible Futures website called A Movement Without Demands. That's a question mark. I'm planning to have a chat with Marco about his ideas around the commons sometime in the next few weeks. In the meanwhile, here's Jody Dean. The old question of demand still afflicts Occupy Wall Street, even though the occupation has now ceased. What do you see as the root of this reluctance to make demands?
I think that the basic root of the reluctance is, we can think about it in two ways, or it's like having two dimensions. The basic first dimension is that the movement has no ideological core. It's got no center. There's not one view. And so because there's not one view or one ideological core, there's no demands that could come from that. So that's the first part. The second reason is that there's no ideological core or single set of view because of the social composition of the movement. There are multiple different social groups, multiple different interests, multiple different ideological backgrounds, different class interests that have come in. And so in the midst of this plurality, there's not a coalition strong enough yet to articulate demand. So it's the social composition and the lack of an ideological core that's at that root. And the thing is that so many in the movement want to say that, oh, no, we're choosing not to make demands. I mean, that's not accurate, right? I mean, for some, there's a choice not to make demands, but there's not a group capable yet. There's not a movement capable yet of making demands, but we're getting there, I think.
Well, then, of course, people would say the lack of demands is a strength of the movement. It emphasizes unity rather than division.
One of the things that is true about the lack of demands that has been great is how much it opens up a space for possibility and desire, right? Everyone's thinking, like, oh, my God, what could it be? Anything is open, right? So as long as you don't say what you want, you're just like, here we are, and people are expecting. And so it creates a great sense of openness and expectation about what will happen. So that's a tremendous part about demands. But how long is that going to go? I mean, how long can that last? I don't think you can have a movement based completely on expectation. Something else has to happen.
Can you have a movement that really has no goals and can claim no victories?
I don't think so. I was having a discussion last night with the artist Jason Jones about this, because Jason was wondering about and pushing the view that there can be a, basically that Occupy Wall Street can be a movement based on dissension and division and kind of perpetually undermining the political conditions that we have. I think that that's a great opening move, but I don't think that's enough. We're going to have some kinds of results, or people are going to get bored and change the channel or do something else.
Well, there's also this strand in American radicalism that has many roots. I mean, you can talk about populist roots, anarchists, whatever, but kind of anti-Leninism, a reluctance to be seen as being anything like a vanguard or a disciplined force. What about that, this anti-Leninism that seems to be a hangover American radicalism, even though, you know, Lenin died almost 100 years ago?
I think it's kind of funny when it comes from people involved in the Occupy movement, because in fact, they are the vanguard, right? I mean, the people who've been getting this started are the vanguard, and so there's kind of like, you know, they protest too much insofar as they want to call this, they want to call themselves not Leninist. So in some ways, there's something that's either just ignorant of Lenin or a little bit disingenuous. On the other hand, maybe there could be some well-considered anti-Leninism insofar as people have been afraid of vanguard movements from their some of their more negative results in the 20th century. On the other hand, my hope is, and I think that this is happening, that the enthusiasm that the vanguard of Occupy has set out or has incited will actually let people, you know, kind of claim their inner Lenin in a way, or claim the exuberance and they will be able to claim the potential that they've already set out, and so that their Leninism, you know, they can stop, basically can come out of the closet as Leninists.
Well, Lenin himself is an enormously flexible fellow. He changes opinion every other year, it seems.
And yeah, that's great, right? And so, and in fact, it's almost like that what Lenin does over time, right, as a matter of duration, the Occupy movements, particularly as they're global, are kind of doing over space or in a kind of present sense. What is it? They're doing synchronically as opposed to diachronically. So whereas Lenin was switching course all the time as he needed to, so is the movement claiming that same kind of freedom to be able to switch course. And so there is actually probably a lot more similarity between Lenin and the movement than people want to suggest.
There's also this reluctance to petition the state, that the business of the movement should be to prefigure, create new spaces, new ways of doing things, and kind of neglect the state. What do you think of that?
Well, I think, I guess, two things. I think on the one hand, a politics that ignores the state is not a politics. I think that the question of when and how the state is addressed should be open. Right now, I think that with respect to demands, too many voices, and I'll just call these, you know, anarchist and autonomous voices in the movement, too many of them associate demands strictly with a demand on the state that the state can either grant or deny or ignore, something like this. The demand always is to somewhere else. But in fact, demands that movements make can be demands on society, right? Lots of the new social movements were social demands. They can be demands on particular workplaces, right? A lot of workplace organizations are demands on workplaces. And they can also be demands that we make on ourselves, and demands that we can make on ourselves as a group or a collectivity. And so I think that demands need to be thought of a lot more broadly than the kind of the very strict view of demands as targeting the state suggests.
Now, what about this idea that the occupation itself was the demand, or it was in some sense prefiguring a new society? Now that there is essentially no more occupation anywhere, what happened to that prefiguration?
I mean, that's a good question, and I actually think that's a good criticism of that version of the prefiguration argument, especially because the claim that, well, this is prefiguring, you know, the new community or, you know, the form of life to come. What it was ignoring was the deep dependence of the occupations on the capitalist setup around them, right? On voluntary labor, yes, but on the fact that there was a pizza place that was going to be available to send pizzas that other folks had the money to earn, to pay for, to have delivered to the occupiers. I mean, the pizza is just one example. But the occupations were depending on their own capitalist context. So to that extent, the prefiguration is not a great one, right? It needs to be the next step needs to be able to think about, okay, how do we change those capitalist relations? How do we change the system that made those occupations possible? And I don't mean this in a way that's critical of the occupations. I mean, you know, we both have noted before how completely exciting and wonderful they've been. So the prefiguration is, you know, we can say more generously, is one of possibility. But to say more of, like, you know, prefiguring, you know, sleeping outside and being dependent on the help of others. I mean, my God, you know, too many homeless people have to deal with that already. That's not really something I would that we need to prefigure. It's already figured.
I'm rather fond of indoor plumbing myself.
Yeah, and plumbing was an issue, right? It remains an issue, and especially now that it's gotten really cold. Cold plumbing. I mean, why do we need to you know, become cavemen, for Christ's sake? I don't want that. That's not a prefiguration that we need. But the good part, right, is to think, okay, we have prefigured I mean, I didn't sleep outside. I also like indoor plumbing, but we have prefigured a collective approach to common needs, right? A collective approach to common questions, a way of thinking like, okay, we've got to deal with the security of the park. We've got to deal with the cleanliness of the park. We've got to deal with the food of the park. We've got to deal with the daily activities of the park. All of those things are kind of you know, nice reminders of what does a society take. And in fact, because they're collective, it reminds us that, oh yeah, all of these things that we have in society that we take for granted are actually all of ours. And we don't have to think about these things that are all of ours in terms of the edifice or shell or, you know, octopus of capitalist property relations.
And then there's an objection to demands which you could call, or you do call, the co-optation objection. Some might call that success, but there's an enormous anxiety around co-optation. What about that?
It's interesting that you're asking about that. I think it was January 3rd, the GA in Zuccotti Park, or next to Zuccotti Park, agreed to what seemed like a demand but was carefully kind of de-demandized and put in the language of resolve, or, I mean, they didn't go so far as to just say, well, we suggest or recommend. They think they said, we resolve to support the claim that corporations are not people. They want an amendment to get rid of corporate personhood. And this is Lawrence Lessig has been pushing this view. And so the GA on Wednesday night agreed to this. Now, here if we think about this as we say, well, it's not really just a resolution, it's actually a demand. Is that a success, or is this a kind of failure? I actually really don't know. I mean, it's not kind of the, it's not really the demand that I would go for. I'm not against it. I wouldn't not support it. But what it does, because it's not part of a larger strategy, is it actually stays within the confines of basic U.S. property relations and basic U.S. political relations. It goes through a basic U.S. political structure in order to, you know, try to reach itself. That's not the best approach to demands for a movement with revolutionary potential, as far as it seems to me. I mean, I would like to see demands put in a bigger framework, one that emphasizes the common and collective potential that occupation opens up.
I'm speaking with Jody Dean, who is a professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith College in upstate New York. Well, something like corporate personhood, that almost seems motivated. I'm very skeptical of this sort of thing. It seems motivated by a nostalgia for kind of 19th century petty bourgeois capitalism of small owners and partnerships. This, I think, partly reflects the social composition of a lot of these movements, which are made up of independent people, a lot of techno-libertarians, who hate the corporate form, but not necessarily always for the right reasons. This is not necessarily something a working-class movement would come up with.
I think that's a great point. I mean, when you were talking about these techno-libertarians, I was like, they like the corporate form until they incorporate, right? Until they get their own, you know, public offering and go, you know, have their own great big giant corporation, and then they're okay with it. I think that the techno-libertarian, the cult of small business, and then the recent graduate and basically recently undergraduate or student basis of the movement makes them think very much in terms of small, local, what they can see around them. It will be interesting to see, and I don't know the answer to this, if any unions are backing it. They might be backing it, but I guess I would be surprised if there were a huge mobilization on the part of unions against corporate personhood. It's something that's, I mean, my God, you don't really need to. Stephen Colbert's already doing this on his TV show on Comedy Central, right, trying to get this as a resolution on the ballot in South Carolina.
Yeah, that's radicalism for you.
Yeah, right? It's as radical as Stephen Colbert. I mean, it's a good thing to have, but you don't need a revolution for that, and you don't need to have hundreds and thousands of people sleeping in parks or, you know, protesting on the streets, right? That's the difference. And this is the thing that actually kind of drives me crazy about the refusal to think about the movement more strategically. In terms of, okay, I mean this we in a kind of global, not just national, you know, we face a world that has developed industry, but this industry is not productive for capital in the same way that has been before. They can't accumulate the kind of capital that they've wanted before. Do we want to then say, okay, no industry? That seems ludicrous. Right? Instead, what there has to be is a more common approach to this industry, right? One that will, I mean, this part of what I'm saying is not particularly new, I mean, at all, but what it needs is to be connected more to the Occupy Wall Street movement. And the thing is that it can be, right? That's why, that if there can be more strategic discussions around things, demands, and where might they go? How do we get a common and collective approach to our shared future, rather than one that's just going to be, okay, you go do this over here and we'll go do this over there, and we'll all sort of hope that our little movements and our little actions will ultimately converge.
Now, before I want to turn to the notion of the commons that you end this piece with, but before we proceed, I would like to interject a note of modesty in that we can offer all friendly criticisms, but on the other hand, it's a lot of these anarchists and autonomists who got this thing going, and a whole lot of old left institutions have been incapable of doing that on our own. So I think a moment's respect is in order.
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely right. And here's the thing, though. Have they opened it up for the reasons that they think they have? Or have they opened it up for other reasons? Like, I think that they want to say that what's opened it up has been the kind of individuality, every voice is heard, every specific individual comes in, and there's this kind of ultimate individuality within the movement. Or have they opened it up because of the power of the collectivity there? And I think it's the latter. And I think that this is where, weirdly, the socialist movements in the United States, or small, tiny parties in the United States, have been very unsuccessful in doing. And I'm not sure if it's because now, after 30 years of neoliberalism, folks really feel the lack of collectivity in our society. They feel the isolation. They feel the sense of, gee, you know, I've been promised that with access to the internet, I can change the world. But instead, I'm making $7.15 an hour, right? Are they starting to feel like maybe they need to combine, so it's actually the collectivity of the movement rather than the autonomy? So I do think you're right. Of course, you know, a note of respect and admiration and complete indebtedness, but also to recognize that maybe the movement's own potential needs to be brought out more, and I think that that's in the collectivity part of it.
Well, one of the things I've toyed with is that the movement, whatever it is exactly, need not necessarily make its own demands in its own name, but it's actually catalyzed a whole lot of energy among other groups, other people, other movements.
Yeah, I've been wondering about this a lot, and on this one, for me, the jury's still out. My biggest worry is that if we call where we are right now phase two, my biggest worry is that phase two becomes exactly where the activistism that you and Liza Featherstone and Christian Parenti discuss in that important essay. What was it, published in like 2004, 2003?
Earlier even, 2002,
earlier even.
Well,
it's also in another book, Confronting Capitalism, that came out in 2004. Anyway, my biggest worry is that what phase two will become is a movement of movements and a bunch of autonomous small actions. Now with a better brand name and symbology than anti-globalization or alter-globalization, but not enough collective power pushed in a specific direction to make a difference. So instead, and because I'm worried about that, I think what can happen is that the different forces, the different social forces in the movement, can end up actually working at cross purposes, so that some of them, some focus on these moves that actually protect small businesses. Some focus on moves that are anti-corporate. Some focus on moves that help upper middle class, kids get better jobs. And instead of focusing on, collectively, we face massive problems that can only be dealt with by bringing down capitalism. So I think that if we're too autonomous here, if we've got too many different things going on, we will end up working at cross purposes.
You wrote this piece with a co-author, and it was something of a learning process for you. Tell us about that.
Oh, definitely. So the co-author is Marco De Serres, and he's now a postdoc at the New School. And Marco started talking to me about his idea that the movement needs to move toward a vision of the commons, and that we need to think about how the commons can provide a kind of strategic anchor would be too strong, but maybe a strategic locus for the movement. He was talking to me about this already the very beginning of October, and he's also participating in setting up a discussion of the common and the commons that I think is going to be at either the New School or NYU in February. And that part of the argument, in fact, much of this argument is basically Marco's, and then Marco convinced me that, yeah, he's right about this. He was more persuaded against some of the criticisms of demands, but then was like, well, as long as demands go in the right direction, we're in favor of it. So this is how. So in some ways, the criticisms that we have reflect our conversation there, and my primarily learning process, as he convinced me that, look, there can be a kind of dual strategy or cooperative alliance between the autonomist emphasis on self-valorization and the practices that we produce, or the movement that we produce through our practices, as well as the kind of more Leninist view that this has got to push towards kind of organized overthrow or subversion of capitalism. So I learned a lot writing about this with him.
And you give an example in the piece of the notion of the common ownership of water as a way of fighting hydrofracking. Could you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, it's Marco's idea, and it's a great idea. He's also drawn from other scholars who are working in this area. But the basic part is, like, look, right now, as the debate about hydrofracking is framed, you have these kind of competing interests around, well, person, you know, some people's property, then they maybe want to tap the resources of the natural gas that's underneath their property, and then other people who live outside that area saying, huh, we really don't want our water to catch on fire, and we don't want to risk a bunch of earthquakes, and we think that this is a terribly dangerous way to try to extract energy from underneath the ground rock, so from the natural gas there. So you get, when you think about the fracking issue in property relations, you get a standoff. But if you recognize from the beginning that there are a number of things in the world that are common, that are part of our common world, and that, in fact, need to be cared for as a commons, right, as a resource that is limited, that we share responsibility for, then we start to see that, okay, water and land are not simply things that some people can claim title to. Rather, they belong to all of us. And if that's the case, then you can argue against fracking from this ground that it's a danger to a common resource, right? It's a danger to our common concern around water. And then you can have, let's say, different sorts of management groups or bureau groups that will say that will have responsibility for taking care of common resources. So the water group might say something like, okay, what are the things that are damaging the water that is our common resource, and what are the things that are helping the water? So pollution, fracking, those kinds of damages would the group would, you know, stop or prevent or try to restrict.
I was Jody Dean, professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Extra Mundane by the 1990s Texas indie band Bedhead. Curiously, one of the band's guitarists, Matthew Cadane, is now a colleague of Jody Dean's at Hobart, where he teaches history and studies the roots of early British capitalism. Till next week, bye.
I can't.